halted, and he offered the boy one of his few words of Russian, as if it were a gift. Little Ivan sneaked a single terrified look at Waltz's face, all covered with red and white makeup, gave a faint moan, and was gone. In all his former life, Walser never frightened children. This child was very much afraid of the clowns, a nervous dread with the seeds of fascination in it. Walser reread his copy. The city precipitated him towards hyperbole. Never before had he bandied about so many adjectives. Walser the clown, it seemed, could juggle with a dictionary with a zest that would have abashed Walser the foreign correspondent. He chuckled, thinking of his chief's brow wrinkling over the dispatch, and slid two gritty rectangles of grey sugar into his tumblerful of amber fluid. He respected his teeth too much to do as the babushka did, suck the sugar lumps, precious as candy, while she sipped. No lemons again. The clowns were lodged among the poorest. He felt a draught on his forehead. His get-up was of the silly kid type, with white shirt, baggy short pants, comedy suspenders, a school cap atop a fright wig, and the wig was coming adrift. Hastily adjusting it, he returned to the keyboard. Dateline St. Petersburg. A city stuck with lice and pearls, impenetrably concealed behind a strange alphabet. A beautiful, rancid, illegible city. Outside in the squalid yard, little Ivan and his friend trapped a stray cat and walked it up and down the cobbles on its scrawny hind legs. They wanted to see the poor, starveling, piteously mewing creature dance, just as its cousins, the suave, mysterious tigers, danced in the circus of Colonel Carney. If one pig trotted off to St. Petersburg to pray, another less pious porker travelled to Petersburg for fun and profit between silk sheets in a first-class wagon-lit. This lucky one, the very good friend of the great impresario, was particularly accomplished. She could spell out your fate and fortune with the aid of the alphabet written out on cards. Yes, indeed, could truffle the future out of 24 Roman capitals if they were laid out in order before her, and that wasn't the half of her talents. Her master called her Sybil and took her everywhere with him. When Walser first presented himself at the Ritz Hotel in London, begging for a job with the circus, feed the elephants, curry the horses, anything that would safeguard his anonymity, Colonel Carney invited his pig to tell him whether to hire the young man or no.
"I'm riding high on the hog's back, young man," said Colonel Carney, in the inimitable lilt of Kentucky. "Allow me to introduce you to the hog in question."
He cradled affectionately in the crook of his arm a lean, agile, inquisitive-looking young sow, whose head sat, with as decapitated a look as that of John the Baptist's on a platter, on a wide, stiff, crisp, white taffeta frill. Her dainty little toe-dancer's trotters were neatly folded under her breast, and her quick, small, bright, not unfriendly eyes twinkled away at Walser like pink fairy lights. She was a delicious creamy yellow in colour, and shone like a pig of gold, because every morning the colonel massaged her with the best olive oil from Lucca to keep her delicate skin from cracking. The colonel chucked her under the chin, making her dangling ears flap.
"Mr. Walser, make the acquaintance of Sybil, my partner in the ludic game."
The colonel lounged at his ease in a swivel chair, his varnished boots up on the desk in front of him among the makings of a mid-morning julep, the bottle of old grandad, the bucket of ice, a bunch of mint that turned the air a refreshing green. A little fat man, with a sparse pepper-and-salt crop bristling on his round head to match the attempted goatee on his chin. He'd no great facility for growing hair. A snub nose and mauvish jowls. A gun-metal buckle in the shape of a dollar sign fastened the leather belt just below his pot belly, presumably the dollar sign to which Feathers had referred. Even in the relative privacy of his hotel suite, the colonel sported his trademark costume, a pair of tightly tailored trousers, striped in red and white, and a blue waistcoat ornamented with stars. The Old Glory itself, topped with a gilt eagle, unfurled with grandiose negligence from a pole propped in the corner. Born in Kentucky he might have been, but no Dixie patriot he.
No profit margin to the bonny blue flag these days. He was all for the stars and stripes.
His shirt sleeves, rolled to the elbow, were secured with nickel bands. His full-tailed frock coat of old-fashioned cut hung from the knob of his chair, on which was perched his billycock hat. He chewed, as on the cud, on a Havana the size of a baby's arm. Lilac aromatic smoke lolled and swagged around his head. His damask walls were layered over with an ill-secured frieze of showbills, on which Walser made his first acquaintance of those who would be his travelling companions. The lady with the big cat, who called herself the Princess of Abyssinia, Buffo the Great and his troop of white-faced clowns, Monsieur Lamarck's educated apes, clever as a barrelload of monkeys, high-wire walkers, earth-shaking elephants, no end to the marvels the Colonel intended to transport about the globe, joined together in amity at the sight of the dollar bill. And there she was again, feathers the most marvellous, flourishing her coccyx at Walser as she took off for some Empyrean or other out of the frame. So many showbills, it was as if the Colonel had rigged himself up a flimsy, impermanent, wonderful tent within the two solid walls of the hotel. Not only did the brightly coloured, loosely pinned posters jostle one another, as if vying for attention as they rippled on the walls, but a mighty torrent of newspaper clippings, contracts, greenbacks, overflowed the enormous waste paper basket he used as a filing cabinet, crisply rustling in the draught from the window, open onto the cheerful bustle of Piccadilly outside. All within seemed in motion, eager to be up and off. On the floor beside the Colonel was a blessedly static barrel of apples. From time to time, the Colonel reached down for a pippin, which Sybil would snap up.
"Yes, sir. We're old hands at the looted game, Sybil and me,"
he rasped, removing the cigar from between his gapped, discoloured teeth and squinting confidentially at the glowing tip.
"Years ago, years down on my daddy's farm in Lexington, Kentucky, I was just a kid then, knee-high to a ham hock, weren't I, Sybil, when I first made the acquaintance of the grandest little lady that ever drank pig swill, present company accepted. Yes, sir, that was Miss Sybil, his very own great-grandma. Yes, sir. First in the great dynasty of my porcine assistants. I, being a young fellow of an idle but persevering disposition, I'd spent my entire 11th year perfecting the technique of the bum flute. Know what I mean? Used to get right up on the school desk when my teacher's back was turned and let rip with the chorus of My Old Kentucky Home on the good old bum flute, while he was riding up the principal rivers of Europe on the blackboard. That kind of young fella I was, could set my mind to anything provided it weren't of any use. Soon as I clapped my eyes on Sybil's great-grandma, there, I said to myself, here's a challenge. Played hooker from school, took me 3 whole months untying effort to get the old girl to stand on her hind legs and wave the flag. Didn't think nothing of it at first, just the way of passing the time. But after I charged my first nickel down at the barroom for a side of the patriotic pig, then yes sirree, we was on the road. Mighty oaks from little acorns grow, you know that, young man. My movable feast, my opera of the eye, my peripatetic celebration of life and laughter, it all began one steamy certain morning all those years ago when the great-grandma of Miss Sybil here got right up on her hind legs and taught me a lesson I never learned in school. Know what it was, young man?
Leering through the screen of cigar smoke, he paused, not for assent, but for effect, before he gleefully sang out the motto of the ludic game,
A fool and his money is soon parted. Ho, 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 he boomed, like Santa Claus. Care for another julep?
He kept a supply of glasses in the top right-hand drawer of his desk.
So, you hail from sunny California by way of the horn, is it, young man? And just like every red-blooded American kid, he wants to run away with the circus.
His pale blue, pebbly, red-rimmed eyes went this way and that way. He never stopped looking at you just so long as it wasn't directly. He wasn't soothing company. There was something restless, something turbulent under his surface bonhomie. He was nobody's fool and did not suffer fools gladly. Walser had no special skills to offer, could not walk the high wire, would have ridden a zebra like a sailor on horseback. Yet all the colonel's bountiful intuition told him the handsome young man might be hired cheaply, was strong, was versatile, was, perhaps on the run, would be a bargain, but might be, not in spite of, but because of all this, trouble. The colonel shared his predicament with his partner.
"What's your opinion, Sybil? Hire or fire?"
She put her head on one side for a moment, scrutinizing Walsh's face. Then she let out a curious gruff little squeak, and nodded, ears jiggling.
"Reckon a handsome young man like yourself can charm a pretty lady the moment she sets eyes on him,"
the colonel remarked seductively, with another sidelong glance at Walser. He took the saliva-rimmed cigar butt from his mouth and knocked 6 inches off the end onto the carpet. Then he brought the famous pack of dog-eared, grease-stained alphabet cards from his waistcoat pocket, flicked through to make sure all were there, cleared the desk of its clutter with a single sweep of his arm. The empty bourbon bottle bounced harmlessly on a red-ribboned pile of court summonses. Breathing heavily, the colonel set out the cards, while Walser watched with bewildered amusement. The colonel dropped the little pig squarely down on all fours in front of the capitals.
"Now, Sybil, tell me next, in what fashion might this bold caballero here delight us?"
Sybil studied the cards for a moment, squinted again at Walser, appeared for a few moments sunk in thought, then, with her questing snout, she nudged out, C-L-O-W-N, and sat back on her haunches, gratified. The colonel rewarded her with a round of applause, tossed her an apple, upset the waste paper basket entirely, and disclosed within its susurrating depths a cache of old grandad.
Uncorking another bottle, "Let the ice and mint go hang,"
he refreshed their drinks. The pig leapt back into his welcoming bosom, where the colonel nuzzled and cuddled her, but his restless eyes, no pinker-rimmed than Sybil's own, kept on going over and over Walser.
"What's his game? What's his racket? Is he the fool he looks, or a bigger fool?" "So, young man," he said, "now you are a first of May. Don't ask me how the cognomen arose. It's what we allus calls the neophytes, the virgins in the ring, the green beginners in the art of playing. Just a couple of questions. First, is it squeamish about bed bugs?"
As Walser, laughing, shook his head,
"That's just dandy, on account of there ain't no place like a circus train for bedbugs. Why, a circus is just one big Pullman diner to sit next lectularius."
Then he contrived to fix Walser with his twitching eye for as long as one entire second, but he went on gnashing away at his cigar, so the smoke bounced round him, and his skinny fingers with the gnawed nails kept tweaking away at Sybil's ears. The pig herself cocked an intent head towards the young man, as if she too was anxious to hear Walser's answer to the second question the colonel was about to pose.
"How does it stand humiliation?"
Startled, Walser coughed on his bourbon.
"I see you don't know the first thing about clownin'," said the colonel in a melancholy voice. "There, well, okay by me. Some was born fools, some was made fools, and some make fools of theirselves. Go right ahead, make a fool of yourself. I'll take you on as an apprentice August, young man. Sign a contract for 6 months, we'll take you across Siberia." "Siberia, oh, the challenge of it, oh, glory across the tundra."
At that, he flipped up Sybil's ear, dipped in, drew forth a stream of little silk handkerchiefs, each printed with the stars and stripes, and waved them round his head.
"Surely I can rely on a fellow American to see the glory of it. All nations united in the great looted game under the banner of liberty itself. D'ye see the grand plan, young man? Old glory across the tundra, crowned heads bow to the democratic extravaganza. Then, think of it. Tuskers to the land of the rising sun, young man. Hannibal Tuskers stop short after the Alps, but mine shall go round the entire world. Never before in the entire history of thrills and laughter has a free American circus circumnavigated the globe.
What a visionary he was.
And after this unprecedented and epoch-making historical event, I'll land you safe and sound back home in the good old U.S. of A. Yes, sir.
With that, he brought his fist, still grasping his streamer, down on the desk, rattling bottle and glasses, and cried out, with neither irony nor sarcasm, but evidently from a full, buoyant, and excited heart,
"Welcome to the ludic game!"
When Walzer first put on his makeup, he looked in the mirror and did not recognize himself. As he contemplated the stranger peering interrogatively back at him out of the glass, he felt the beginnings of a vertiginous sense of freedom that during all the time he spent with the Colonel never quite evaporated. Until that last moment, when they parted company and Walzer's very self, as he had known it, departed from him, he experienced the freedom that lies behind the mask, within dissimulation, the freedom to juggle with being, and indeed, with the language which is vital to our being, that lies at the heart of burlesque. Her orisons concluded, the babushka lay down on top of the stove, and soon began snoring. Walzer typed, "And," to his report, for fear the rattle of his machine disturbed her ancient sleep. He did not want to draw attention to his reporting activities, but he was doomed to his comic rig for his stay in the city, because the clowns walked the streets in peripatetic advertisements for Colonel Carney's circus. Therefore, he went to the kitchen door and whistled little Ivan away from his game. Even if the child found the presence of clowns inexpressibly sinister and troubling, he could be bribed with a few kopecks to take Walzer's sealed envelope to the British Embassy, whence it returned to London in the discretion of the diplomatic bag. Walzer saw how the child hated to touch his hands. Unless he wanted to walk to work with a hooting, mocking company of half the ragtag and bobtail of the city at his heels, he must skulk along the backways, along stinking alleys hung with washing, past gloomy doors of stark tenements. Of this most beautiful of cities, Walzer, as it turns out, has in reality seen only the beastly backside. A yellow light in a chemist's window, two noseless women under a street lamp, a drunk rolled under a doorway in a pool of vomit. In a scummed canal, ice in the pelt of the dead dog floating there, mist and winter coming on. Feathers, nestling under a Venetian chandelier in the Hôtel de l'Europe, has seen nothing of the city in which Walzer lodges. She has seen swans of ice with a thick encrustation of caviar between the wings. She has seen cut glass and diamonds. She has seen all the luxurious, bright, transparent things that make her blue eyes cross with greed. Their paths converge only upon the brick barracks of the Imperial Circus. Chapter 2. The Colonel coaxed, wheedled, insisted, demanded that the Old Glory should, during his visit, replace the Tsar's own flag on the pole that topped the Imperial Circus, and there it slumped, as if succumbed to the lethargy of the alien air. The circus itself, constructed to house permanent displays of the triumphs of man's will over gravity and over rationality, was a tall hexagon of red brick, with a pompous flight of steps up to an entrance flanked on either side by 10-foot stone carotids, splashed with pigeon droppings in the shape of caparisoned elephants, squatting on their hind legs and holding their front legs up in the air. Such were the guardian spirits of the place, the elephants, the pillars of the circus itself, who uphold the show upon the princely domes of their foreheads as they do the Hindu cosmos. Once the paying customer successfully negotiated the ticket window, one left one's furs in a cloakroom that, during performance, became a treasury of skins of sable fox and precious little rats, as though there one left behind the skin of one's own beastliness so as not to embarrass the beasts with it. Thus disencumbered, one entered an ample foyer with a mirrored champagne bar and climbed another, this time a marble and interior staircase, to reach the arena. Along the ring bank were red plush boxes trimmed with gilding, the plushest signed with the Imperial Eagle in gold. Above the performer's entrance hung a gilded platform for the band. All was elegant, even sumptuous, finished with a heavy, rather queasy luxury that always seemed to have grime under its fingernails, the luxury peculiar to the country. But the aroma of horse dung and lion piss permeated every inch of the building's fabric, so that the titillating contradiction between the soft white shoulders of the lovely ladies whom young army officers escorted there and the hairy pelts of the beasts in the ring resolved in the night-time intermingling of French perfume and the essence of steppe and jungle, in which musk and civet revealed themselves as common elements. Under the ring, in the cellarage, was housed a menagerie which the imperial beasts had temporarily vacated in favour of those of Colonel Kearney. A tunnel led to a walled courtyard out at the back. Into this courtyard, Walser now let himself, by means of the modest wicket gate, the performer's entrance. At this dead hour of the afternoon, under a sad sky tinted the lavender of half-morning, the courtyard was empty, but for a small bird with long legs, who pecked with a gourmet air the fibres out of a mound of yellow elephant dung on the cobbles. A smashed bottle, a rusting can, a pump dripped water which froze as it hit the ground. The only sounds drifting from the menagerie, the continuous murmuring purr of the great cats, like a distant sea, and the faint jingling of Colonel Kearney's elephants of flesh and blood as they rattled the chains on their legs as they did continually, all their waking hours, since, in their millennial and long-lived patience, they knew quite well how in 100 years, or 1,000 years' time, or else perhaps tomorrow, in an hour's time, for it was all a gamble, 1,000,000 to 1 chance, but all the same there was a chance that if they kept on shaking their chains, one day, some day, the clasps upon the shackles would part. It was a forlorn place. The homeliest touch, a row of freshly washed white muslin frocks, pegged out on a clothesline, and they were creaking already in a rigor mortis brought on by the first hints of frost. The Princess of Abyssinia must have put all her frocks in the wash, because when she came out to collect her laundry, she had on just a petticoat, and a chemise with, over everything, a terrible apron, stiff with blood, from waitressing her carnivores. She unpegged each frost-starched garment and wrapped it sharply at the waist, so that it bent enough to hook on her arm. She was a slim thing with dreadlocks to her waist. In the ring, she looked like a child as she sat at the white Bechstein grand, big enough for two of her, and played for her roaring familiars. But close, too. Her face, though neither lined nor wrinkled, was ancient as granite, with the blunt, introspective features of Gauguin's women, and a soft, matte, bitter brown in colour. Crack! Of her thin musician's hand on her dresses of ice. The gate into the lane outside opens. Enter Lizzie, in her jacket of the fur of, it might be dog, her stiff boat of unseasonal straw, carrying a tray covered with a white cloth that does not quench the delicious smell of fresh pancakes. Lunchtime. She kicks the gate shut with her foot, and trots up a clanging metal fire escape to an upper door she leaves a swing behind her. From this open door, drifting on the stagnant air, a raucous voice raised in not unmelodious, if brassy, song.
"Only a bird in a gilded cage."
Then that door, too, banged shut. Walser wrenched his eyes from the closed door and ducked down the tunnel on his way to the ring. What a cheap, convenient, expressionist device this sawdust ring, this little O, round like an eye, with a still vortex in the centre. But give it a little rub, as if it were Aladdin's wishing lamp, and instantly, the circus ring turns into that durably metaphoric, ouroboric snake, with its tail in its mouth, wheel that turns full circle, the wheel whose end is its beginning, the wheel of fortune, the potter's wheel on which our clay is formed, the wheel of life on which we all are broken. O of wonder, O of grief. Walser thrilled, as always, to the shop-soiled yet polyvalent romance of the image. The magic circle was now occupied by Lamarck's educated apes. A dozen chimpanzees, six of either sex, all in sailor suits, were seated in pairs at little wooden double desks, each with a slate and slate pencil clutched in their leathery hands. A chimp in a sober black suit, with a watch chain looped athwart his bosom, a mortarboard at a rakish angle on his head, stood at the blackboard, armed with a cue. The pupils were hushed and attentive, in marked contrast to the young woman in a grubby print wrapper, who sat on the plush-top barrier of the ring, idly filing her nails with an emery board. She yawned. She paid them no attention. The chimps put themselves through their own paces. The trainer's woman was no more than their keeper, and Monsieur Lamarck, a feckless drunkard, left them to rehearse on their own. Walser could make no sense of the diagram chalked on the blackboard, yet the chimps appeared to be occupied in transcribing it to their slates. The partings in the centres of their glossy heads were white as honeycomb. The professor made a few swift passes with his left hand and pointed to the lower right-hand corner of the diagram. A female towards the back of the class raised her arm eagerly. When the professor pointed his cue at her, she performed a sequence of gestures that reminded Walser of the movements of the hands of Balinese dancers. The professor considered, nodded, and chalked in another arabesque on the diagram. The neat, shining heads at once bent in unison, and the air shrilled with the scratching of a dozen slate pencils, a sound like a flock of starlings coming into roost. Walser smiled under his matte white. How irresistibly comic, these hirsute studies. Yet his curiosity was piqued by this mysterious scholarship. He squinted again at the diagram, but could not tease a meaning out of it. Yet there seemed to be. Could it be? Was it possible? Was there writing on the blackboard? If he crept round towards the Tsar's box, he might be able to see better. Stealing softly across the tiered benches in the clown's long shoes he had not yet learned to master, the clumsy toe knocked against an empty vodka bottle left in the angle of a step. The bottle skipped down the rest of the tiers and banged against the barrier. At this unexpected noise, the silent group all turned and fixed the intruder with 13 pairs of quick, dark eyes. Walser slipped onto a bench and tried to make himself inconspicuous, but he knew he had stumbled on a secret when the lesson immediately stopped. The professor whipped out a yellow duster and wiped off the diagram in a trice. The girl who'd asked the question solemnly stood on her head on the lid of her desk. Her deskmate took a catapult from his pocket and struck the professor full in the face with a juicy ink pellet, inducing in him a farcical and gibbering outrage. Their bored keeper went on filing her nails. It was only the apes at school number. Faced with this insurrection in the classroom, the professor happily discovered a cache of dunce's caps stacked behind the blackboard. He bounced round the ring, disposing a cap on each capering head, then, on impulse, leapt lightly across the barrier, and Walser got a dunce's cap too. The professor's face, grinning like a Cheshire cat, was not 6 inches from Walser's own as he popped it on. Their eyes met. Walser never forgot this first, intimate exchange with one of these beings whose life ran parallel to his, this inhabitant of the magic circle of difference, unreachable but not unknowable. This exchange with the speaking eyes of the dumb. It was like the clearing of a haze. Then the professor, as if acknowledging their meeting across the gulf of strangeness, pressed his tough forefinger down on Walser's painted smile, bidding him be silent. The chimps, effortlessly recapitulating their entire routine, now raced round and round the ring upon the fleet single wheels of monocycles. They had all flung off their sailor suits to reveal satin shorts beneath, and they played all manner of tricks on one another. Some stuck their clever five-fingered feet in one another's spokes to dislodge the rider, while others clambered onto the saddles of their monocycles and balanced there on one leg until the force of gravity brought them low. But Walser noticed how the professor glanced at these frolics with an air of grave melancholy, while the chimps themselves seemed to take no pleasure from the sport, going through the motions with a desultory mechanical air, longing, perhaps, to be back at their studies, whatever they were. For nothing is more boring than being forced to play. In the distance, a vague roaring of the great cats. The professor, as if coming to a decision, took hold of Walser's hand. Though no more than 3.5 feet tall to Walser's 6+, he was a remarkably strong and determined little fellow, and forcibly persuaded Walser down the aisle to the ring. The spinning chimps came to a halt, dismounted, dropped their bikes, and clustered round him in a gesticulating circle, so that he could have sworn they were discussing what to do with him, although the confabulation took place in noisy silence. Just then, Samson the strong man arrived, in his tiger-skin loincloth, fresh from raising his weights, his thighs and biceps gleaming with oil. But the strong man paid as little heed to the chimps as they to him. The ape-man's woman put away her emery board, however. The professor pointed to Walser's dunce cap. The chimps rocked back and forth on the palms of their feet, as if in soundless laughter. Then the female who'd asked that salient question, Walser recognized her by the green bow in her hair, startled him badly. She jumped right up in his arms, and clutching his torso with her hairy thighs, reached up and behind, found the stud at the back of his neck that released his entire shirt front. Off it snapped. Down she jumped. The strong man's hand released a small white breast from the overall of the ape-man's woman, while her own freshly manicured fingers set free from its tiger-skin cache-sex, a tool of proportions commensurate with the owner's size, curved like a scimitar. Both were oblivious to Walser's plight. Green hair ribbon laid Walser's shirt front carefully down on a nearby desk and gestured him to take off his patchwork jacket. Nervously, Walser looked to his new friend, the professor, for advice. The professor nodded, yes. What do they want of me? Walser asked himself, undressing obediently. When the professor picked up his cue again, the chimps returned to their desks to take up their pencils, and Walser tentatively answered himself. Perhaps an anatomy lesson? Clearly the apes had suffered a surfeit of practical biology demonstrations, for they had no eyes for their keeper, stretched out as she was full length on a red plush banquette, while the twin moons of the bum of the strong man rose and fell above her, although outside her field of vision. Now, Walser wore nothing but the dunce's cap, which they did not bother to remove, although they made him take his shoes off so that the professor could check the number of his toes. It occurred to Walser they thought his white, red and black clown makeup was his real face, and they were, perhaps, sympathetic to him, because they thought he might be some relation to the baboon. Were they, he pondered, grappling with Darwin's theory from the other end? Green hair ribbon returned to her desk, and the lesson started in earnest. Walser stood before them, nude and exemplary, and the professor prodded him in the thorax with his cue. Not urgently, making those swift passes of the hand with which they seemed to communicate. Walser wilted under the scrutiny of the eyes of his little cousins twice removed. Squeak, squeak, went the slate pencils. Prod went the cue. Walser obediently turned round to present the class with his backside. The professor expressed particular interest in the vestigial remains of his tail. A profound and unusual, even disturbing, silence now filled the building, broken only by the rhythmic grunts of the copulators. The professor made a few brisk movements, as if introducing a new theme. He turned Walser round to face his class once more, and the eructation of the slate pencils broke out again, when the professor lightly touched Walser's mouth with his cue and persuaded his lips apart. Then the professor went to fetch a bucket some careless hand had abandoned in the ring, upturned it, and stood on it, the better to peer inside Walser's mouth. After that, he stared directly into Walser's eyes, producing afresh in Walser that dizzy uncertainty about what was human and what was not. How grave how beseeching the professor looked as he started to open and close his own mouth like a goldfish reciting a poem. The grunts of the strong man began to accelerate. Walser presently understood the professor wanted him to speak to them, that his speech was of surpassing interest to them. The professor continued to perch on the bucket, gazing ardently within Walser's mouth at play of tongue and uvula, as Walser hesitantly began. "What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty!" The strong man accomplished his orgasm in a torrent of brutish shrieks, such a hullabaloo that Walser stumbled over his recitation, but in the midst of the strong man's ecstasy, Sybil burst into the ring as if shot from a gun at a remarkable turn of speed for a pig. She sent the desks and scholars flying. Her white ruff was ripped and askew, and she was screeching as though it was sticking time. She cleared the barrier in a mighty bound and promptly went to earth in the royal box, never letting up her hellish racket even as she burrowed deep under the velvet carpets for safety. The strong man bellowed, Sybil shrieked. There rose up the desolate cry of the colonel, whose pig was in danger, and, from the menagerie, suddenly, came an immense fugue of roaring, as if all the cats were stops on a gigantic organ that was being played flat out. Then, a fearful shout.
"Tiger out! Tiger out!"
The professor kicked over the clanking bucket in his haste. His pupils leapt over the overturned desks and shinned up the poles to the orchestra platform to crouch in a huddle among the music stands, big-eyed and twittering with agitation, full of atavistic jungle terror. The lovers on the plush banquette rose up, white-faced and shaking. Walser, naked, abandoned by the apes, thought, "I shall not meet death in a dunce's cap," and snatched it from his head. He ran. He vaulted the barrier and was halfway up the amphitheatre towards the main exit when, Lot's wife-like, he could not resist a backward glance. The tiger ran into the ring, hot on the scent of Sybil. It came out of the corridor, like orange quicksilver or a rarer liquid metal. A quick gold. It did not so much run as flow. A questing sluice of brown and yellow, a hot and molten death. It prowled and growled around the remains of the chimp's classroom, snuffing up its immense flaring nostrils the delicious air of freedom, fragrant with the scent of meat on the hoof. How yellow its teeth were, the festering teeth of carnivores. The strong man tore off the woman's clinging arms, clutched his loincloth around his privates, and made for the auditorium door. He was a fine specimen, in prime condition. He swung from tier to tier of the seating, past Walser, struck like a pillar of salt, up and away. The exit banged to behind him. Walser heard the sound of the shooting of the bolts. Now the only way out of the ring was that by which the tiger had entered it. "I am in a perfect death trap," thought Walser. The ape-man's woman, her ankles as securely trapped by her dropped knickers as if the garment had been a pair of bolas, let out a blood-curdling scream. "We are in a perfect death trap," thought Walser. When the tiger heard the woman scream, it knew that something better than pork was on the menu. It arched its back. Its tail stood to attention. It raised its heavy head. Its yellow eyes went round and round the ring like searchlights, seeking the source of the scream. The terrified woman scrambled out of her underwear and ran along the circular bank of seating. The tiger's swiveling eyes caught sight of her. The tiger scratched with its hind paws, raising little puffs from the sawdust. It laid back its round, disingenuous ears. Her wrapper, flapping like a sail, caught on an ill-hammered, jutting nail, and tripped her up. She fell forward on her face in the gangway. Walser recovered the use of his limbs. Before he was aware he had made a decision, he hurled himself down the amphitheatre towards the amber-eyed brute, just as it was about to spring. Involuntary as his heroics, Walser let rip a tremendous, wordless war cry.
"Here comes the clown to kill the tiger!"
Kill it? How? Strangle it with his bare hands, perhaps? Chapter 3 Then There was a room hissing with greenish gaslight, in which Walser opened his eyes to see a looming figure dipping lint into a bowl of pink water, powerfully redolent of carbolic acid. He lay on some kind of daybed. It was his blood tinged the water pink. He closed his eyes again. Fevers reapplied the damp lint to his shoulder without gentleness. Now he was conscious, he howled. "Easy does it," advised Lizzie, tilting the rim of a mug of hot, sweet tea to his lips. "Tea with canned condensed milk in it. English tea." Fevers did not release her pressure on his dressing. She wore a stern white shirt, secured at the throat with an emphatic necktie, but this did not render her in the least masculine. Upholstered in the snowy linen, her bosom looked as vast as its mother's does to a child as she bends over its bed in sickness. Her displeasure was palpable. "So you've run away to join the circus, have you, love?" she asked, not quite pleasantly. Evidently she no longer felt the need to call him Sir. Walser twitched between her ministrations, disturbing the shawl in which they'd wrapped him. This shawl was made from dozens of little squares of knitted wool, sewn together to form a patchwork, and its workmanship had the touching incompetence of that of children. "First, real evidence," he noted, "of the existence of the tribe of Cockney nephews and nieces they were always talking about." His wig was gone, and his hair was sopping wet.
"Tiger took one swipe at you, and then the princess turned on the housepipe," said Lizzie. "Whoosh! Blast 'em with water, that's the trick. Knocks the breath out of the buggers, knocks 'em backwards. Then you scoop 'em up with a net."
There were comforting, familiar things in Fevers' new dressing room. A gilt clock, topped with Father Time, stopped at 12. A dog-eared poster on the wall. A puffing spirit kettle. Lizzie made him drink more tea.
"Course it isn't a tiger, exactly," Fevers informed him. "Didn't give you a chance to check out his privates, did it? Tigress, female of the species, deadlier than the male and all that." "Charging a bleeding tigress," exclaimed Lizzie. "What the hell got into him?" "He was having it off with the ape-man's missus, wasn't he?" said Fevers in a flat tone.
She pressed too firmly on the compress, so Walser howled again.
"No use denying it." "Quick work," said Lizzie. "She's a pincushion," said Fevers. "I take it," said Lizzie to Walser, "that you wish to remain incognito." "We're the only ones that know," said Fevers, in the tones of one pondering blackmail. "But what the hell's his game?"
Lizzie asked Fevers, as if he were not there.
"I'm sure I don't know." "I'm here to write a story," he said. "Story about the circus. About you and the circus," he added in as conciliatory manner as he knew how. "That involves screwing the ape-man's missus, does it?"
She eyed the compress narrowly and let it alone, tipped the bowl of water into the slop pail under the washstand, and wiped her hands on her pleated skirt with a dismissive air. Yet, as if obeying a scenario that predated their disappointment with him, the women treated him with rough compassion. A frock-coated doctor soon arrived to bandage his scratches, whom Fevers paid.
"Settle up with me later," she said,
in the accents of a tart, with a 24-carat heart. A female chimp, wearing a green hair ribbon, delivered a pile of neatly folded clothes, and wig and school cap too, and they dressed him up again before they sent him back to Clown Alley. Fevers even slapped a hasty coat of wet white over his features to preserve his disguise for him, since his right arm hurt far too much for him to do it for himself. All the same, he felt himself diminished in their eyes, and was glad to get out of the dressing room. As he closed the door behind him, Lizzie said thoughtfully to Fevers,
"How do you think he gets his dispatches through the censor?"
In some pain, and painfully aware that by the very heroicness of his extravagant gesture he had made a fool of himself, just as the Colonel had predicted he would, Walser made his shaky way through the courtyard, where the mittened and muffled children of the wire-walking Charivaris were now playfully teetering along the princess's empty washing line. It was already dark. From the monkey house, echoing on the night air, came a rhythmic thud as the ape man beat his woman as though she were a carpet. Chapter 4 Clown Alley, the generic name of all lodgings of all clowns temporarily located in the city in the rotten wooden tenement where damp fell from the walls like dew, was a place where reigned the lugubrious atmosphere of a prison or a madhouse. Amongst themselves, the clowns distilled the same kind of mutilated patience one finds amongst inmates of closed institutions, a willed and terrible suspension of being. At dinner time, the white faces gathered round the table, bathed in the acrid steam of the babushka's fish soup, possessed the formal lifelessness of death masks, as if in some essential sense they themselves were absent from the repast and left untenanted replicas behind. Observe, in his behind-the-scenes repose, Buffo the Great, the master clown, who sits by rights not at the head, but at the magisterial middle of the table, in the place where Leonardo seats the Christ, reserving to himself the sacramental task of breaking the black bread and dividing it between his disciples. Buffo the Great, the terrible Buffo, hilarious, appalling, devastating Buffo, with his round white face and the inch-wide rings of rouge round his eyes and his four-cornered mouth like a bow tie and mockery of mockeries under his roguishly cocked white conical cap, he wears a wig that does not simulate hair. It is, in fact, a bladder. Think of that. He wears his insides on his outside, and a portion of his most obscene and intimate insides at that. So that you might think he is bald, he stores his brains in the organ which, conventionally, stores piss. He is a big man, 7 feet high and broad to suit, so that he makes you laugh when he trips over little things. His size is half the fun of it, that he should be so very, very big, and yet incapable of coping with the simplest techniques of motion. This giant is the victim of material objects. Things are against him. They wage war on him. When he tries to open a door, the knob comes off in his hand. At moments of consternation, his eyebrows black and bushy with mascara shoot up his forehead, and his jaw drop as if brow and jaw were pulled by opposing magnets. Tusking his tongue against his yellow gravestone teeth, he fits the knob back on again with exaggerated care, steps back, approaches the door again, with a laughably unjustified self-confidence, grasps the knob firmly. This time, he knows it is secure. Hasn't he just fixed it himself, but... Things fall apart at the very shiver of his tread on the ground. He is himself the centre that does not hold. He specializes in violent slapstick. He likes to burn clown policemen alive. As the mad priest, he will officiate at clown weddings where Grick or Grock in drag is subjected to the most extravagant humiliations. They do a favorite, Clown's Christmas Dinner, in which Buffo takes up his Christ's place at the table, carving knife in one hand, fork in the other, and some hapless August or other is borne on with a coxcomb on his head as the bird. Much play with the links of sausages with which the bird's trousers are stuffed. But this roast, such is the way of Buffo's world, gets up and tries to run away. Buffo the Great, the clown of clowns. He adores the old jokes, the collapsing chairs, the exploding puddings. He says, "The beauty of clowning is nothing ever changes." At the climax of his turn, everything having collapsed about him as if a grenade exploded it, he starts to deconstruct himself. His face becomes contorted by the most hideous grimaces, as if he were trying to shake off the very wet white with which it is coated. Shake, shake, shake. Out his teeth. Shake off his nose. Shake away his eyeballs. Let all go flying off in a convulsive self-dismemberment. He begins to spin round and round where he stands. Then, when you think, this time Buffo the Great must whirl apart into his constituents, as if he had turned into his own centrifuge, the terrific drum roll which accompanies this extraordinary display concludes, and Buffo leaps, shaking, into the air, to fall flat on his back. Silence. the lights dim. Very, very slowly and mournfully, now strikes up the Dead March from Saul, led by Grick and Grock, the musical clowns, with bass drum and piccolo, with minuscule fiddle and enormous triangle struck with back kick of foot, Grick and Grock, who contain within them an entire orchestra. This is the turn called the Clown's Funeral. The rest of the clowns carry on an exceedingly large coffin draped with a Union Jack. They put the coffin down on the sawdust beside Buffo. They start to put him in it. But will he fit? Of course he won't. His legs and arms can't be bent, won't be bent, won't be ordered about. Nobody can lay out this force of nature, even if it is dead. Pozzo, or Bimbo, runs off to get an axe to hack bits off him, to cut him down to coffin size. It turns out the axe is made of rubber. At long, hilarious last, somehow or other, they finally contrive to load him into the box and get the coffin lid on top of him, although it keeps on jerking and tilting, because dead Buffo can't and won't lie down. The clown attendants heave the coffin up on their shoulders. They have some difficulty coordinating themselves as pallbearers. One falls to his knees, and when he rises, down goes another. But sooner or later, the coffin is aloft upon their shoulders, and they prepare to process out of the ring with him. At which, Buffo bursts through the coffin lid, right through, with a great rending crash, leaving behind a huge ragged hole, the silhouette of himself in the flimsy wood. Here he is, again, large as life, and white and black and red all over. Thunder and lightning, did you think I was dead? Tumultuous resurrection of the clown. He leaps from his coffin, even as his acolytes hold it high, performing a double somersault on his way to the ground. He started out in life as an acrobat. Roars of applause. Cheers. He darts round and round the ring, shaking hands, kissing those babies who are not weeping with terror, tousling the heads of bug-eyed children teetering between tears and laughter. Buffo, who was dead, is now alive again. And all bound out of the ring, led by this demoniac, malign, enchanted reveller. The other clowns called him the Old Man, as a mark of respect, although he was not yet quite 50, hovering about the climacteric of his years. His personal habits were dominated by his tremendous and perpetual thirst. His pockets always bulged with bottles. His drinking was prodigious, yet always seemed somehow unsatisfactory to himself, as if alcohol were an inadequate substitute for some headier or more substantial intoxicant, as though he would have liked, if he could, to bottle the whole world, tip it down his throat, then piss it against the wall. Like Feathers, he was Cockney born and bred. His real name was George Buffins, but he had long ago forgotten it. Although he was a great patriot, British to the bone, even if as widely travelled as the British Empire in the service of fun. "We kill ourselves," said Buffo the Great. "Often we hang ourselves with the gaudy braces from which we suspend those trousers, loose as the skirts that Muslims wear, lest the Messiah be born to a man. Or sometimes a pistol may be sneaked from the lion tamer, his blanks replaced with live bullets. Bang, a bullet through the brain. If in Paris, you can chuck yourself under the metro. Or should you have been so lucky as to be able to afford modcons, you might gash yourself in your lonely garret, might you not? Despair is the constant companion of the clown. For not infrequently, there is no element of the voluntary in clowning. Often, you see, we take to clowning when all else fails. Under these impenetrable disguises of wet and white, you might find, were you to look, the features of those who were once proud to be visible. You find there, per example, the aerialist whose nerve has failed, the bareback rider who took one tumble too many, the juggler whose hand shakes so from drink or sorrow that he can no longer keep his balls in the air. And then what is there left but the white mask of poor Piero, who invites the laughter that would otherwise come unbidden. The child's laughter is pure, until he first laughs at a clown. The great white heads around the long table nodded slowly in acquiescence. The mirth the clown creates grows in proportion to the humiliation he is forced to endure. Buffo continued, refilling his glass with vodka. And yet, too,
You might say, might you not, that the clown is the very image of Christ?
With a nod towards the mildly shining icon in the corner of the stinking kitchen, where night crawled in the form of cockroaches in the corners.
The despised and rejected, the scapegoat upon whose stooped shoulders is heaped the fury of the mob, the object, and yet, also he is the subject of laughter. For what we are, we have chosen to be. Yes, young lad, young Jack, young First of May, we subject ourselves to laughter from choice. We are the halls of mirth, for like a hall we know what we are. We know we are mere hirelings hard at work, and yet those who hire us see us as being perpetually at play. Our work is their pleasure, and so they think our work must be our pleasure too. So there is always an abyss between their notion of our work as play and ours of their leisure as our labour. And as for mirth itself, oh yes, young Jack.
Turning to Walser and waving an admonitory glass at him,
don't think I haven't very often meditated on the subject of laughter, as in my all-too-human rags I grovel on the sawdust. And you want to know what I think?
That they don't laugh in heaven, not even if it were ever so.
Consider the saints as the acts in a great circus. Catherine juggling her wheel, St. Lawrence on his grill, a spectacle from any freak show, St. Sebastian, best knife-throwing stunt you ever saw, and St. Jerome with his learned lion with a paw on the book, great little animal act that, beats the darky bitch and her Joanna hollow, and the great ringmaster in the sky with his white beard and his uplifted finger. Foam all these and many other less sanctified performers put on their turns and the endless ring of fire which surrounds the whirling globe, but never a giggle, never a titter up there. The archangels can call, bring on the clowns, until they're blue in the face, but the celestial band will never strike up the intro to the march of the gladiators on its harps and trumps, never, no fear. For we are doomed to stay down below, nailed on the endless cross of the humiliations of this world. The sons of men. Didn't you forget me, lad? We clowns are the sons of men.
The others all droned after him in unison. We are the sons of men. As in some kind of clerical response.
You must know,
continued Buffo to Walser, in his graveyard intonation,
you must know that the word clown derives from the Old Norse, cluny, meaning loutish, cluny, cognate with the Danish, kluntet, clumsy, maladroit, and the Yorkshire dialect, gormless. You must know what you have become, young man, how the word defines you. Now you have opted to lose your wits in the profession of the clown.
A clown,
they murmured softly, dreamily amongst themselves.
A clown. Welcome to Clown Alley.
Meanwhile, to the accompaniment of Buffo's sermon, the meal went on. Spoons scraped the bottoms of the earthenware bowls of fish soup. The spatulate, white-gloved hands reached for the shanks of black bread. Food sad and dark as the congregation of sorrow assembled at the ill-made table. Buffo, scorning a glass, now tipped vodka straight from the bottle down his throat.
There is a story told of me. Even of me, the great Buffo, as it has been told of every clown since the invention of the desolating profession,
intoned Buffo.
Told once of the melancholy Domenico Biancoletti, who had the 17th century in stitches. Told of Grimaldi. Told of the French Piero Jean-Gaspard du Barreau, whose inheritance was the moon. This story is not precisely true, but has the poetic truth of myth, and so attaches itself to each and every laughter-maker. It goeth thus. In Copenhagen once, I had the news of the death of my adored mother by telegram the very morning on which I buried my dearly beloved wife, who had passed away whilst bringing stillborn into the world the only son that ever sprang from my loins, if spring be not too sprightly a word for the way his reluctant meat came skulking out of her womb before she gave up the ghost. All those I loved, wiped out at one fell swoop, and still at matinee time in the Tivoli, I tumble in the ring, and how the punter's bust a gut to see. Seized by inconsolable grief, I cry, "The sky is full of blood!" And they laughed all the more. How droll!